This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about Wizards of the Coast's latest controversy with D&D Beyond promising to retract all the old spells and items from all the old character sheets, and then doing an about-face within a week. Why is it so hard to manage backwards compatibility in games and software? All of that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Dan, before we get going on this topic, I just want to remind everyone, as always, I was about to say, but actually not this time. I was about to say there's an after party chat today, but is there an after party chat today?
There's an after party chat, yes.
Okay, right? Great.
For select guests, Paul. Not everyone can get in. Who can get in, Paul?
So normally at the end of every show, we host a private chat on our Discord server for our patrons. That's a live video chat with Dan and I. That starts a few minutes after the hour, around 2:10 Eastern time. And anyone can join in that by simply becoming a patron. Visit our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier and you'll get an invite to the Discord server. And get that done before this show ends and you'll be able to join in then the after party chat at the end of the show today. Apologies for being a little flaky on that, but I personally, unfortunately, won't be there today, unusually. But Dan will still be there to host the chat. So please do join him.
We love it. I love it. And in particular, we love new people showing up to the after chat. If you haven't been there before, we would love to see you there on our private Discord server. So, Paul, if we go back to the beginning of last year, actually 2023, we had a couple of episodes of an enormous gaffe, just an enormous stumble by Wizards of the Coast in how they're handling the current production of Dungeons & Dragons, where they had a major announcement they were going to cancel the open gaming license and throw the entire third-party support system into complete chaos, generated an enormous amount of rage, frankly. We did a couple of episodes about that with some great guests back in January 2023, and then they flip-flop, and they whiplashed really hard in the opposite direction of released everything permanently under a different license, which was a really surprising outcome. Now, here we are, September 1st of 2024, and they've done something very similar in the last couple of weeks. Maybe you can pull up a couple images that we have. So I think it was around August 20th, and you start seeing game news sites like this. This is Wargamer.com, and you get a headline that says, D&D Beyond is deleting all the 5th edition spells and magic items. The digital platform is keeping most of 5th edition, but deleting all of its old spells and magic items, replacing them with 2024 content. And this is pretty close to completely true. And the claim from a changelog on D&D Beyond was that all existing character sheets on the digital service D&D Beyond would have all of the items, all of the spells, all the magic gear, all that stuff automatically converted from 2014 rules to 2024 rules, whether the players wanted it, whether the DMs wanted it, whether they were prepared to do that, whether they were getting the new books or not. All the existing characters in the entire system would be automatically converted into this new system. And I think what the fine print said is, if you want to keep using old spells and gear and equipment and armor and weapons and magic items, you can. You just have to recreate every single one of those items using the homebrew system on a custom manual basis. Sure, you can do it. You can keep playing the way you want. You just have to personally recreate all of it in the system. you know, no problem, you know, because that's gonna no problem. And so there were, I think, in the last couple of weeks on social media, there were a lot of fifth edition DMs and players kind of terrorized that before my next game system, before my next game session, I've got to recreate all of the stuff. I've got to recreate all of the custom items or download all of the character sheets in perpetuity. That seemed like a bad prospect to me.
Dan, it feels like every time we're talking about Wizards of the Coast on our channel, it's to talk about their latest crazy gaffe and retraction. This hardly seems like a surprise. More, it's just another iteration of the same pattern that we've seen from them over and over again, right? Like,
right.
I'm trying to think of what the one prior to the OGL one was, but I'm sure that's not the first one. I feel like when we were doing those episodes, we were talking about like, oh, Wizards done it again. They've done something terrible.
I mean, there was a problem with Magic the Gathering that actually landed in the Wall Street Journal, right? Of like, they're like Wizards of the Coast is destroying the market value of Magic the Gathering, and not being a Magic player, I can't even remember what that was at this point.
Was that when they sent the Pinkertons to someone's house? Is it
right?
That?
Right. Yeah. Well, that was part of it. Yeah. Right.
Pinkerton. Okay. Anyway. Anyway, I'm not surprised. Oh my gosh! Come on, Wizards. What are you doing? I mean, at least they're, you know, at least when they step in it, they're willing to like listen to their fan base and take a step back and change things. But This is bizarre.
Let's look at a couple of these social media posts. Like I pulled out three. Well, there's a lot, but I pulled out three just to kind of get a taste for these. And so if you go look at the orange, yellow, green items, so you get things like, and I pulled some stuff off Twitter. Right, there's one with no dot. Right, this one. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's totally right. So here's Gil Bandini, and he's snapshotting the parts of the whole post on the D&D Beyond changelog there. In particular, the part on the right there says if I want to use the old version of Magic item, you can use the old version. They have been entirely replaced. You're just going to need to create homebrew versions of all that stuff. And Gil Bandini, he says, well, I'm done using D&D Beyond for 2014 games. Time to look for another source. WotC's completely disregarding the tables that don't want to update content, current games to 2024, because that's a nightmare. And taking away both purchased features and options is a mad slap in the face to the audience. And then if we look at the yellow dot one there, this is Steve Agaza saying, congratulations, you actually managed to give me a good reason to move on. With my owned content no longer supported, the tools are literally useless for me and my players. The funniest thing is that I was even thinking about maybe giving 2024 a try. No way I'll risk any more with you. And finally, finally here is Aonix. And I believe she's saying, if this is going through, I will literally never purchase a WotC product ever again. D&D Beyond is what I use to run my games, and me and my friends have spent a lot of money for it. Imagine telling everyone you are deleting all of their ebooks. I will dead ass switch to Pathfinder Second Edition.
You know what it reminds me of, Dan, is their stance on PDF copies of our beloved classic versions of D&D. If you remember back a while back, there was a point where they pulled digital PDF versions of all the old stuff because they were freaked out about copyright. Yep. And then, of course, that spurred on the creation of retro clones. And, you know, I think a lot of people I knew just were like, well, I guess piracy is cool then, because it's the only way to get them. You know, and then eventually they retracted that. And now you can get the official PDFs from them once again. So I'm not terribly unused to this process from Wizards. And for me, it really strikes me as yet another growing pain example of them trying to figure out how to switch from being a print company to a digital company, right? Because think about it, right? You and I still play all these old, wonderful old versions of D&D, and we can, right? Because we bought the books, and you can't take the books away from us. We have them. We can keep playing them. Right? But when your distribution model is digital and everything is online,
yes,
suddenly,
yes,
right, releasing a new version, it seems reasonable from a publisher perspective to say, well, we're just going to get rid of the old one and whatever. If people want to still use it, they'll still use it. We don't care. They're not our customers anymore, so it doesn't matter to us. Just release the new stuff. But because of the distribution model and the way people access these rules, you are taking it away, right? You're literally going into their houses and pulling their books off of their bookcases. Not literally, but figuratively.
Let's look at what they said. So the conclusion, of course, is 1 week later, they did a perfect 180 flip around and said they weren't going to do that. On social media, Wizards had, as usual, a very brief statement. I suppose you could pull that up. It's got a blue dot on there, yep. Paul. Yep. And so here you are on social media just about 7 days later. Players who only have access to the 2014 Players Handbook will maintain their character options and their spells, their magic items, and their character sheets. Players with access to both can select from either source when creating new characters. And then you will not, need to rely on Homebrew, like we said a week ago, to use your 2014 player options, including spells and gear and magic items. On their, so we're looking at that on their full change log. What they went into more depth about is they said, for their update, they said, last week we released a change log detailing how players would experience the new rules. We heard your feedback loud and clear, and we thank you for speaking up. Our excitement around the 2024 core rulebooks led us to view these planned updates as welcome improvements and free upgrades to existing content. We misjudged the impact of the change, and we agree that you should be free to choose your own way to play. Taking your feedback to heart, here's what we're going to do. And basically, you get this snippet on social media there. So it's interesting that, who knows what the truth is, but the claim there is like, well, we just assumed everybody would want a free upgrade. Who wouldn't want that? And I agree that from a general conversation about Wizards, I think I've had this in my head since at least the late 90s of, will the owners of D&D ever get software right?
Ever? I mean, no, clearly not, right? Like, this is old hat to folks like you and I, Dan, who made our living making software for a very long time, right? Exactly. That, like, they just don't understand the concept of deprecation, right? That you have to, if you're releasing a new version, you have to release it at a point when the old version is still available for backwards compatibility of all the people using the old version, so that then they can do a comparison side by side and choose to migrate to the newer stuff, right? And then down the road, yes, you can stop supporting the older version, assuming that everyone has either migrated or found another way, right? But yeah, no, this hard change of like, nope, just on this date, everything's flipping, right? Could you imagine if, say, Windows was released that way? I bring this up because, as Dan knows, like, it was just a week or two ago that I finally upgraded our streaming rig to Windows 11. Which I'm pretty sure is named 11 after the year it was released. Is that true?
I can't remember. Okay, they have, because they keep flip-flopping what the naming protocol is. I totally understand why you say that. So now it is supposed to be the 11th edition, the 11th version of Windows.
Okay, no. Okay, but still, I'm looking it up now. It came out in 21. So here it has taken me 3 years since release to actually bother to install the thing. And frankly did it so because, they're saying, well, we're going to stop supporting 10 because we gave
and
you
I'll
plenty
say,
of time. And I can't argue with that. They did. 3 freaking years.
I'll say I feel like this is a constant struggle and it's a legitimate dilemma for software publishers. And I'll say that for me, I was pretty happy on Windows 7 for quite a while. Windows 8 was not, people were not fond of. They couldn't make a Windows 9 because weirdly the text string conflicted with Windows 95 from back in the day. So the jump was 7 to 8 to 10. And they were, in fact, trying to, Microsoft actually was trying to force Windows 10 on Windows 7 machines, and I was one of the people that actually got a third-party application installed in order to block the forced Windows 10 upgrade. So it's a movement that, you know, it's a movement that companies really struggle with forever. Like, Paul, maybe we ought to talk about, so to me, it's funny because, again, one of the funny things about this situation at the moment with Wizards is, you know, policies can change. Okay. And they did a whiplash 180 in a week. Now, it's one thing last year with the OGL, like, here's our policy, here's the license that we distribute content with. Okay. But this here, like you're saying, is a software issue. If you have a system and we're about ready to go to switch everything over, and then Monday rolls around and the management comes in and says, nope, we have to support both by the end of the week. Is that doable? Yeah. Is that even doable as a software engineer?
It's difficult. Is it doable? I mean, it depends on the systems, I suppose, but like, that's a very short timeline to do so, right? One would hope you would get a lot more advanced notice and more planning around the release, right? Like, that's release planning. That's how release planning works. To switch how you're doing it a week in advance is terrible. Yeah, I'm sure that the folks at D&D right? Beyond are absolutely scrambling at this point to make these changes to support releasing them both at the same time. They probably got a whole lot of features they have to add.
Right? Like, hypothetically, okay, as little as we know about how D&D Beyond is engineered, hypothetically, if you had the system and it was about to just switch over and someone came in and said, no, we need to support both options, like, what would you want? What would be your first guess for a project estimate? Like, how much time do you think you would want to estimate to create that new?
I don't know, system? But I cannot estimate that, Dan. That's knowing their software not at all. I can't possibly estimate that. But what I would say is, it would be very reasonable to come back and say, well, you got to delay the release. That's the most obvious choice, right?
That's what I'm thinking is will this actually delay the switch over to the 2024 rules? Will we see delays with the D&D Beyond switch over as a result of this? I also feel that seems pretty likely to me.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised at all. Unfortunately, it's very possible, again, if we assume that they are struggling to switch their mindset from print process to digital process, and they don't really understand or respect the amount of work that you and I both know is going through the D&D Beyond offices right now, that that they might push too hard for it and try to get it out anyway and really bungle it. Mm-hmm. Right? If I was a D&D Beyond user, I would absolutely be prepared for that day to be a nightmare. Right, maybe go export your D&D Beyond characters to PDF and print them out, just so you can play via paper for a few weeks or months.
A lot of people, I think, have already done that, like in advance of their flip flop. A lot of people have done exactly that. I think that's excellent advice. And the possibility of a bungled release was thought 1A for me. Yeah. Thought one was that should be delayed, and then 1A is they probably won't, and it will be bungled, or possibly both.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Sounds about right. And it's tough because, like, it's just such an obvious thing, right? It's to delay because, like, if you just release nothing, you're not going to provoke any problems, right? If you just delay, if you just go slower, it will be better for you in the long run. But I understand there's energy beyond the creators have been working hard at making the content and getting it ready for release, and they're excited for the fans who want it to have it. Yep. I don't know.
Agreed. They might, you know, I could imagine pushback in the direction of people saying, well, I was planning on this. I expected to have this available. We've got playtests about to run. You know, maybe someone had a streaming campaign that they expected to start on a particular date. maybe something like that would have to get pushed back, and there might be some grief about around issues like that, possibly.
I wonder now, Dan, is there a comment in here about the how reasonable is it to release a physical role-playing game in a digital format? Is that wise? That's the question I want to ask. Is that wise? Yes, I'm immediately, of course, summoning to mind, Jeff Goldblum sitting there and saying to the D&D Beyond team, you spent so much time, you know, trying to figure out if you could, you didn't stop to question whether or not you should. I can't think of any other role-playing game that is, you know, that is a traditional role-playing game, right? Not a video game, a traditional normal tabletop role-playing game that is trying to push towards a digital format. I mean, they must exist. I'm sure they exist. But, like, is Pathfinder, does Pathfinder have this problem?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, much like D&D, they've had, you know, an open SRD, like the kernel of the rules. I mean, because it is the same kernel as the rules as third edition D&D originally, you know, it's available on a website for free, has been for many years. I question mark about how many people try to actually run games purely just on that resource.
Like, the only other example I'm thinking of right now that's coming immediately to mind is there is a phone app for DCC, for Dungeon Crawl Classics, that most people I know who play Dungeon Crawl Classics use because it's helpful. But it's definitely like an add-on, right? It's not, you don't need it. It's not required, right? It's not useful in its own. It's not like I can just get that app and we can all sit around and play DCC. You still need the books. And maybe you have those as PDF. Instead of a physical print book, but that's about as digital as that gets, I think.
Pretty good comment by Kilroy32 just came through saying Lancer RPG makes big use of an app, which players actually love and is super useful. I think Lancer is by the person that makes the webcomic Kill 6 Billion Demons, I think. And Paul, you and I have friends that actually adore Lancer, as a matter of fact. Telling us about that a couple weeks ago. Interesting. I mean, I sometimes ponder myself about having a game whose rules are fundamentally online, but the problem is I think about, oh, that would make change management really easy, because a person could just go change it and it was live, but then you run into exactly this problem about what if someone doesn't like the changes and want the old version.
Let's imagine for a second, Dan, that you were going to release, instead of an RPG, let's say that you're going to release, I don't know, something like, say, a collectible card game, and you're going to do it digitally online, and you're going to make it have features like hidden cards and multiple play areas and stuff like that, that take advantage of that digital format to add interesting, exciting features, such that it really truly is only playable digitally. Like, imagine a crazy world where a product like that exists. How would you handle releasing updates or changes to the game?
It just changes, and everybody sucks it down and deals with it.
There you go. That's
quit.
That's what Wizards is doing, right? So maybe they're doing it right. I don't know.
This is the business where Paul and I met.
if we weren't
for working at a company called Genetic Anomalies, which was bought by THQ later on games such as Chronex and With Authority and Star Trek Conquest Online, which we used exactly 25 years ago,
we were making this game.
really before its time. And we, to be clear, we weren't principals. The first game existed before we were hired at the start of our careers.
Counterexample. sorry, let me give you a weird counterexample, because like you might argue, well, it doesn't really apply in that case because the game was always digital, right? It was always digital and people just expect updates. It's a video game and that's how video games work, right?
Yes, yes.
But take a look at, say, like Magic the Gathering Arena made by Wizards of the Coast. They have departments in the company that get this stuff, right? Yes, they have cards that are made for Arena specifically that do things that you couldn't possibly do in a physical game of Magic the Gathering. Now, they also try to have parity with the actual physical game as well. And that results in some unusual things. Specifically, there's a little badge for Arena-only cards. And you can see it. When you visually look at the card in the game, it has a little icon that says, this is an Arena version of this game, of this card. And you can even have two copies of the same card that seem like the same card, but one is the Arena version and one is not, and they are actually different. And I've had this. I've played Arena, and I've had this case of looking at these two cards and being like, why are they different? Why are they different? And then realizing, oh, this one's the Arena version, and this one is the one that has parity with the print version. And the way they do this, then, is when you're going to play a game, there's a bunch of options for what style of game do you want to play. Do you want to play an Arena pure Arena game, which is just Arena cards? Or do you want to play... I know I'm getting the terminology wrong, folks, for Arena players. I know I'm screwing it up. The formats have other names, but the idea is the same, right? They have, right, they have formats where, like, no Arena cards, because we want to emulate what it's like to play with physical cards. And it's confusing and weird and difficult. They're working through it, right? They're working through it by essentially doing exactly what you and I are saying, which is support both! Support both side by side, and then give players the option. Do you want to play with the things that are constantly getting updated and fixed, or do you want to play with the things that match what was printed?
Now, interestingly, at least a little touch of that is going to be happening on D&D Beyond here, Paul, is even before the flip-flop, the old stuff they're going to tag with a badge marked Legacy, and the new stuff won't have that. And I think it was part of the plan all along that things like character classes, character races from the 2014 books would be continue to be supported, marked with this Legacy badge. I guess monsters would still be available with the Legacy badge according to their old profiles. So maybe they got that idea at least from the Magic the Gathering experiences. You got me curious a little bit.
Yeah.
So not knowing about this, what is like one or two of the features or something that show up on Arena cards that don't exist on physical cards?
The big one I'm aware of is there is a card that has a special keyword called, I think, Spellbook, which says that this card represents a powerful wizard and they have a series of spells. And so when you play that card, the spell cards, the cards that are the spells that wizard has in their spell book, go appear in your deck, right? And I think there's some randomization there. You don't know exactly which ones or where in your deck they will appear, et cetera, right? So there you go. It's like modifying the makeup of your deck invisibly to you, right? With some randomization, et cetera. But even more
generating
minor,
cards on the fly.
Even more minor, I will say that there was a card that I was using that I had. So the funny thing is, the way I was playing Arena was I was excited to play for a little while in person. So I had some physical cards, and I had an Arena account where I was trying to emulate the decks that I was building with the physical cards, so I could test it against bots or players online or what have you. And there was one card where I noticed that it had like two rules. I can't remember exactly what they were, but it had two rules on it, and when I was trying to build the deck online, one of the rules was gone, was missing. And I went and like hunted online to be like, why is this different? And realized it's because I had the Arena version of the card, which had been fixed because they discovered that the card was a little broken. It needed balancing. And it's easy to do that in Arena, right? They could just update the rules and push it out and done. But they left also the physical version for folks doing the kind of thing I was doing. But I just had my settings wrong where I had to like filter that out to say, well, then don't show me this card because this is the Arena version of the card. I need the one that emulates the physical version, the broken physical version, right? So.
Okay.
Yeah. So now you're clearly using Arena not just for mechanics that are impossible in physical play, but they're clearly also using Arena just so that they can roll out quick hot fixes without having to print a whole new set of cards and without having to retcon cards, yeah. Which is a thing they do with the real physical game, right? They're constantly listing, these cards are no longer legal.
Yep, totally. Now, Paul, you're making me remember that, interestingly, and now maybe there's nuance to this. So when I was working on Chron-X, I had a significant dispute with the head designer at the time. So I was doing some design work, which was considered to be unusual. So part of the thing that I was working on is we were making a new map area, and it was going to be the Antarctic. It was going to be basically the original game you could possibly fight on any one of the six continents, and then we added, as an expansion, we added Antarctica. Now, as part of that, there was going to be a new card set that had a bunch of like Antarctic specific themed things, right? So units that were particularly good. So I think that there was like a mechanic of like you were slowed or things were more expensive, I guess things were more expensive in the Antarctic map, except for a specific, except for things that had the keyword Arctic on them. And then they would avoid that extra cost, that extra slowdown. Now, there just happened to be in the original set, there just happened to be one card that had like Arctic themed art, right? So they were all bundled up in the artwork. And I can almost remember what the name was. And it seemed clear to me that this should also be tagged with this new Arctic keyword, that they should also get this benefit. And the lead designer put their foot down and said, absolutely not. We never change cards retroactively. We never change keywords, I think. We never change keywords on cards retroactively. Totally unacceptable. And so the mechanic became, you avoid the extra expense if you have Arctic or you're this one other card. which to me seemed really awkward, right? Yeah. Seemed really, really awkward. And I was like, I mean, it's not going to change how they function in any situation that ever existed. It only indicates how it functions in this brand new situation. So it seemed odd to me. But the policy at the time was absolutely don't change keywords on prior cards. So we kind of ran into that same kind of problem, expanding, right? Thinking that it was an expansion and whether we were allowed to change prior cards in that context or not.
It's fascinating because there's a good and bad, or like a different sides of the same coin here for the case for digital distribution of games, right? Is that on the plus side, like, yes, you can fix mistakes, right? Like, oh, whoops, this is overpowered, or this wording is awkward, right? And I'm thinking about, like, I'm remembering, you know, when we play paper games, when we were playing third edition D&D and it was brand new and it was still all very much paper driven, absolutely not, you know, it was a character generator, but let's not talk about that. There would also be errata, right? There would be like, you would go to the website and download the errata and maybe print it out and stick it in the inside of your book to have on hand and be like, okay, well, this rule has actually changed and now it uses this way. So like the ability to just fix that stuff and push it out is very attractive. But on the flip side, you get this case, right? Where people are like, but I want to keep playing with the old stuff. I don't want all these changes. I don't want the new thing necessarily. Like, not until at least I've seen it, right? Not until I've seen it and played with it and go, yes, that's better, I want it.
I remember working at Papyrus Racing, and I think it was like around NASCAR Racing 2 or something like that. And there was a debate. I feel like it was a user interface issue of, do you do it version A like we used to, or version B like our designers feel is a better design at this point? And there was argument on both sides, and some of us were very conservative. Again, what was Papyrus Racing, my first job, is now iRacing. And they do great work there. And I remember, you know, someone said, well, make it a setting. Let them do both. And that was certainly an easy way out of the debate. But now you have to support both. And how many times do you get to use that as an out to a design debate like that before you start having to, how finely do you cut the back compatibility? So I can see with Magic the Gathering, if you have Arena and you have Standard, and you know maybe D&D Beyond will be at a point where you've got 2014, 2024 rules. And I think, you know, World of Warhammer also has, you know, classic and current, I think. But how finely do you cut that up to make the customer base happy? Do you, every like revision, is that a possible setting maybe? And does your development team have time to manage that and regression test that all the time to make sure nothing's being broken when you make changes? You start to go down this path of of a code base that becomes very fragile as a result.
I mean, the thing that I'm reminded of now is I've worked on some online games where, yes, it's very frequent that we had to create a new feature and support the ability to turn it on and off as desired, with the idea of ultimately not necessarily serving, just player choice, but for the sake of A/B testing. And for folks who don't necessarily know what that is, literally we would release the feature turned on for a small subset of the player base, call them Group A, and then also not have that feature available for the rest of the player base, call them Group B. And then we would test, do they like this feature? Is it working? Is it making the game better? Before deciding either to retract it and say, nope, turns out it was a bad idea, or to push it out wide. Now, the interesting thing about A/B testing is they don't even know it's happening, right? Mm-hmm. You don't tell the people which group they're in or that the test is even happening, right? You just push it out like that. And now, cynically, I'm wondering, is Wizards going to eventually do that with D&D Beyond? Are you going to see different groups get different rulings because they're in a test group and don't realize it? That would be fascinating.
My personal guess would be I could imagine them doing that for like user interface elements, like when they make a virtual tabletop. Yeah. I could imagine that. I bet they must know that if you are fiddling. I mean, and this would be a Magic the Gathering experience too. They must know if they start fiddling with actual rules to the game, people are going to notice instantly, immediately, right? And start complaining about it. Even with this situation this week, at least they were aware. At least if they're aware that there's two different rule sets.
yeah.
Right. And even to begin with, they were saying, "Well, you'll keep this, and we're gonna have to change that."
And it's tough. I think there's, you know, for a game that is a role playing game, right? Where like ultimately, what's being pushed is not an automated system, right? Like you're not pushing code changes that implement the rules. You're just pushing the publication of the rules, right, in written form for a human to digest. And that adds another layer of danger, right? Like, what if I push a rule change out there, quietly fix something, and it goes out there, but people just don't realize it, and they continue playing with the old rule because they just don't know, and they've memorized the old one.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That happens with, we see, first edition players, right? I think we see first edition D&D Dungeon Masters pick up fifth edition and then still have rules from first edition still stuck in their heads and need to be, you know, informed that something changed back in 1990. I think I see conversations about which edition is it?
We see it all the time when I try to run OD&D and just realize that I've just ingested so much BX that I just accidentally sometimes rule some stuff in BX rulings without realizing it. It's a fascinating problem, but I could totally see, and I don't know if this is good or bad, but I could totally see an argument forming up from the design space of, this is why we need rules automation. We need D&D Beyond and our virtual tabletop and all this stuff to just implement the rules. That way the DM doesn't have to know them. And that way the system just implements the rules for them. Great.
Okay, so I'm gonna bathe in the rather convincing argument that someone's gonna say that sincerely. And I think you're right that probably someone will be pushing for that, actually.
You know, it's funny because I used to complain when 3.5 came out. Well, 3.5 was like the breaking point for both you and I, Dan, of modern D&D, where we were like, maybe this isn't the game for me, and maybe I want to try something different, right? And that's, I think, when you started looking at more old school stuff. I found solace in Savage Worlds for a while before coming back. The interesting thing is, I've lost my train of thought. Where was I going with this? crap. Right. I used to say back then that 3.5 was, that one of my biggest problems with 3.5 was it was the board gamification of the game. I said, like, a lot of the rules are pushing us in this direction where the game is becoming less about role play and more just about tactics. And they are trying to convert D&D from being a role playing game into being a board game. And I feel like they pulled away from that. I mean, I think they leaned into it in fourth edition, but they pulled away from it. Fifth edition is certainly a return. But maybe now we're seeing the video gamification of D&D.
Certainly the attempt. Now, it's interesting that the last Twitter post that we put up threatening to switch over to Pathfinder, I thought was very interesting, because I think that Wizards maintains throughout the organization maintains a lot of scar tissue over that fourth edition switch. And I distinctly remember at the time they publicly declared with fourth edition, we want to get rid of the old player base. We want a new player base that are people that play World of Warcraft. And we want rules that are automatable in something like D&D Online, a massively multiplayer online game. And we with fourth edition, we want rules they specifically said that are video gameable. And as part of that massive switchover, and I do think that fourth edition is the most dissimilar to any other edition of D&D, for the only time in history, D&D dropped to second in sales behind Pathfinder. Pathfinder, which, you know, branched off using the OGL as they were allowed to do, and making something that was more traditional D&D. For several years there, Pathfinder was the top seller and D&D was the second seller. Never happened before, never happened since. And I think that with the last two editions of D&D, fifth edition, whatever this current one is, right? the marketing at Wizards has gone so far out of their way, to do the anti-fourth edition thing of saying, we want everyone to play this. We want old players, new players, no, people that have never heard of D&D. We want everybody. We want everyone who's ever played any edition of D&D. We want this to be welcoming to them. And in both cases, both 2014 and 2024, they've said, it's going to be back compatible. It's going to be compatible with any edition of D&D, original, first edition, or whatever. It's compatible with everything. And, you know, in order to avoid that cutting off of any of the market. But have they overpromised? Is that actually a viable promise that we're making all these changes and it's also fully compatible? Maybe they've overstretched themselves. Maybe they've overcompensated for that really bad mistake with fourth edition. Maybe they've been promising a level of compatibility that they really can't fundamentally deliver. Maybe that's how they backed into this problem. I think about that a lot.
It's possible, certainly possible, that they've overcommitted. I mean, do you think that those promises were just made off the cuff without really thinking about the costs and the expense of and the difficulty, the challenge of supporting all of that? Because it's a big claim.
I mean, I get the feeling that that's one of the marketing department's mission statement, the prime directive of Wizards marketing since, you know, fourth edition is we'll never make that mistake again. We're going to, everybody's welcome and everything's compatible is we've got to sell that. Now, I do think that you might be in a situation of your software sales team. We've got a contract and we sold these features. And then your engineering team says, we don't have those features. We don't have those features. And we can tell you how long it would take to make them, and we could estimate an expense on how like to make them, but you sold something that we can't deliver today. And I think in a lot of companies, it's sales driven, right? I think the top CEOs tend to come from sales departments.
What you've just described is the classic conflict between the sales department and the engineering department of any software company ever. This sales is promising stuff that we don't have. And could possibly
How well I know, Paul.
Yeah.
How well, so I feel that might be the situation, and you know, sales gets the yoke and they get to drive in that direction, and engineering might be trying to catch up afterwards all the time.
I want to throw before we run out of time here, I want to throw a comment I saw go by in the chat up here, because it strikes me as interesting. If you assume that I am right, that we are seeing this gradual progression towards wanting, the game is becoming more complex. We're seeing more digital tools. Are they trying to move to a point where like, yep, we want to be a company that produces software, not a company that produces print materials. We want D&D to be an online experience that people use computers for character sheets, for their virtual tabletop, etc. To the point, possibly to the extreme, eventually, of when there are no physical books at all. So Kevin wrote, yes. My heirs will definitely be able to read my D&D books and my character sheets on paper. And that is I wonder if anyone has brought that up over at Wizards, this possibility of if you go to the extreme of this direction, you lose the ability to archive. And I've seen this in video game development. Video games that I worked on 20 years ago, they're on a disc somewhere with the proper emulator. I can get them out and I can play them. Video games I worked on 10 years ago, not the case, right? They are so dependent on so many other third-party systems that may or may not still exist, probably are not... don't have paid accounts if they do exist, that you just couldn't run them. You just can't. It's just not possible. And I wonder if that's going to be eventually the fate of D&D. If we go this direction where, you know, because I know they're developing internally their own custom, you know, virtual tabletop using Unreal 5. I've heard this a lot. And if we get to that point where your character sheets are in D&D Beyond and you're using their virtual tabletop and you actually can't play D&D without these tools, Will the future versions, will the wandering DMs of the 2040s or 2050s be able to say, I hate the current thing, I'm going back to good old D&D 5.5 or whatever it is they're going to call it? Maybe the answer is no, right? You might lose the archivability of these games.
I'm so glad you brought that comment up from Kevin, because I also wanted to touch on that same. I think that's a really important observation. I wanted to touch on it pretty much the same way, Paul. I remember, having a game coming out of Papyrus Racing that we were very proud of for Windows 95. And I think it was within 10 years afterwards, I wanted to show it to somebody, and it's unrunnable. And to my knowledge, there's not even any emulator that can make that particular game work. And I'll say that, you know, and that's exacerbated with games that expect online always connectivity that, you know, requires some kind of live server. And you see all kinds of conflict around that when games become defunct. And I'll say that, you know, that morally hurt me, right? That even when at the job where we met each other, it morally hurt me that these games wouldn't be archivable and wouldn't be playable years later. And it was a little, you know, it wasn't the predominant reason, but it was a little thread of the reason why I got out of video games myself, is that actually did kind of trouble me on a moral basis. And frankly, just in the last month, on the same point, I'm removing some clutter from my folks' place back up in Maine recently to help them out. And, you know, I have some very old books. Okay. I have some very old programming books. Great. I got it right here. I can crack it open. I can read it. No problem. And then I have like a lot of programming work that I did when I was first learning programming that's stored on cassette tapes for a TRS-80 color computer. Now, I don't know how to connect a TRS-80 color computer to any kind of modern device to either view it, run it, or download it. So the call that I made is I don't have any way that I can think of to access or save or archive that programming work, frankly. And I think I just got to ditch it as far as I can tell. So that hurt me, but bit rot's a real thing. And that really concerns me. It's a real issue to me.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating. I suppose there's an argument that the archives of the future of archives of RPGs will not be the archival of the rules, but rather the archival of the videos of the actual play sessions.
I mean, nothing lasts forever. And boy, if there's a day that you know, YouTube is like, oh, it's no longer profitable, go to something else. Boy, that's going to be a heck of a moment someday.
I wonder what YouTube's archival policies or whatnot will be. I remember as a kid, my dad taking me in New York City to the Museum of Television and Radio, maybe. And it's just this giant archive, man. Like, because it's not like there are displays or whatnot. There's just little booths where you can go and sit in front of a television, and they just have all the archives of all the crazy old stuff. And I remember sitting down and watching TV shows that he loved from the 40s with him. You know, is that kind of place gonna exist for the future of media?
I don't know. You know, libraries are shipping, you know, a lot of libraries are shipping their books out to, you know, some kind of warehousing situation nowadays in favor of that. And I'll say I've never been to that place, Paul, but anyone that's ever been has always said it was an astounding experience.
It is a fascinating place. Absolutely fascinating place. Yeah. So I don't know. I feel like we've drifted quite a bit, Dan, from the topic here, or maybe not. Maybe this is all part and parcel of it.
Project management, Paul. It's a hard task, mistress.
I guess I'll say at this point, like, I'm looking at the clock, Dan. I'm frankly, I was going to try and bring us back to the topic, but we're out of time. We're out of time, Dan. So I'm just going to sidestep it and pass it to you and say, you have any final thoughts, Dan, on Wizards' attempt to forcibly migrate everyone to the new version of D&D and then backpedaling due to popular backlash?
I mean, I think this is the conversation that I wanted to have with you, Paul, frankly, about this. And I do think that it's a struggle. You and I have personally struggled with this in our gaming jobs and software, and we've seen the makers of D&D go back and forth between this. And, you know, I had it on tap, but a couple of years ago, I saw a conversation with Frank Mentzer over, like, I once had a debate with Gary Gygax about this rule. And what he called a presumed axiom is that everything that ever happened in Zero Edition, in original D&D 50 years ago, had to be capable of happening in First Edition. And that we might be expanding the rules, but we absolutely will not be changing anything that ever happened. And that might have been too much in the other direction, frankly. And you can see why that's obviously the opposite, the polar opposite of where Wizards, I guess, wants to go, of have everything, you know, changeable at by fiat all the time. So you can see that, you know, you can see over the editions of D&D and over our work in video games that it's a legitimate struggle to determine how much support we give. Now, I will say that generally it seems like the leadership at Wizards in specific seems that they're either kind of asleep at the wheel or they're just not there at all. for how players, you know, want to actually interact with the game, surely there's some experienced game designers on staff, and I think that the executives should listen to them more. That's going to be my conclusion. Wizards executives, please listen to the experienced game designers that you have. They have been through these battles before. You don't have to have more Waterloos over and over again. Listen to your design staff. They know what they're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I think that's very accurate. And my assumption is that what's happening at Wizards is it is such a big company now that the left hand's just not talking to the right. As I was mentioning, right, like they've solved this problem, whether or not in the best way possible, but they did think about it and solve it for Magic the Gathering Arena. Why was no conversation had about it for Dungeons and Dragons? And my guess is just those two departments are just clearly on opposite ends of the campus and just not talking to each other about, not sharing this kind of information. It's really unfortunate because I think as Dungeons and Dragons and other like print versions, as the company tries, and I might be totally wrong here, but if we assume I'm right, that the company is trying to move away from print and towards software, should maybe talk to the experts in software that they have on hand because they exist.
One little footnote. I believe someone noticed a couple days ago that Wizards' senior director of communications left for another job. And I can't help but wonder if that person was just like, this job is impossible. No one can do this. I'm out of here, suckers.
Could be. I will say, at least they're willing to take accountability and make a change. Like, if nothing else, it's terrible that they keep stepping in it like this and need this horrible backlash across social media. But at least they listen when it happens and they change their stance. Something, not nothing.
It's a true statement. It's absolutely a true statement. They should have planned it out in advance, but it's a true statement. It is surprising. Sure. Not many companies do that.
If you have opinions on archiving of role-playing games, the video gamification of D&D, as I'm calling it, or just how one rolls out edition changes and continues to backward support existing changes, or just any thoughts at all about this current kerfuffle that you want to get out there, please leave us a comment in the YouTube video here. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe you'll have some surprising thoughts for us that we hadn't thought of, and maybe that'll spin up a new topic for us in a future episode.
Absolutely. We'd like to see that. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on social media like YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and GitHub and places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites. So please find that like button, mess it up.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also listen to us through various third-party podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Just like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7 about old school D&D, new school D&D, and science fiction, miniatures, and horror games, and everything that we love. And we just have the best, most knowledgeable, wisest patrons. And if you have any questions, they will be able to give you a lot of great suggestions for fixing your game. Like we said, in about 10 minutes, we will have the video after chat there to continue the conversation. Paul's going to have to step out for a day, but I will be there to host it, and if it'll be your first time, we will really enjoy seeing you there. Now, Paul, we are going to be off next week. That's September 8th. There is some wandering going on, so we will have an off week on next Sunday, September 8th, but maybe tell us what's happening the week after that on September 15th.
Yeah, the September 15th, please tune in. We will have a special guest on the show. We will be joined by Adam Rutskarn de Camp, author of chocolatehammer.org. There's a lovely article that he wrote all the way back in January of 2019 about using the Boot Hill system to run a political intrigue campaign. Absolutely fascinating. Brought to our attention by listener, viewer Adam Flynn. Thank you so much, Mr. Flynn. Really, it was a topic that you and I wanted to dig into, Dan, and I'm super excited that we got the original author to come on and talk to us about it.
Definitely, and I've been looking for an excuse to talk about Boot Hill for a while, so we get to talk a little bit about the pros and cons of a Boot Hill campaign. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Excellent.
So viewers, don't forget, we are live almost every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again in 2 weeks, September 15th, for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.